We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about some of the challenges faced by programs across the country that provide legal services to the indigent. Now, it's been more than 40 years since the Supreme Court ruled that when a person is charged with a crime and cannot afford to hire a lawyer, the government must provide one. The problem is, across the country, these systems of legal defense for the poor are in trouble. In this part of the show, we'll be talking with Joanne Wallace. She is the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. She's had that job since 2005. Before that, she served as the senior vice president at the association. She also worked for the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia for 14 years, serving as its director for 6 years. So as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana. There's a toll-free line that's 800-222-9455. And if you would like, you can send us an email. That's will-talk. That's the address, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. We do ask people to try to stay on track with the topic, try to be brief, and in doing that, you'll make room for other people. That way we can get in as many different people as possible. Certainly, though, questions, comments are welcome. And Ms. Wallace, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We can talk about this in some detail, but I think probably the issue to get at right at the beginning is this, or the question is this, how well is government doing, particularly at the state and local level, at fulfilling this obligation to provide attorneys to people who can't afford them?
Well, David, right now we're in a state of crisis in indigent defense in this country, and that really has been going on for a very long time. So at the end of the day, not well is the answer. Hmm. The Attorney General of the United States, even in remarks starting in 2009, acknowledged that indigent defense in this country is in a state of crisis where often people don't get lawyers, and people will often get a lawyer who doesn't have the resources to adequately defend him or her. So we have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. And I am sure that people would say that over time, certainly since Gideon v. Wainwright, which was the Supreme Court decision that essentially said if people can't afford to hire a lawyer, one will be provided. I'm sure that on the one hand, it's true that the resources that have gone into this over time have gone up, but it seems that the case is that the need is so great that even with some increase of resources over time, that there's still a big unmet need.
That's correct. There is a very large unmet need. And you're also correct that, you know, there have been more resources over time. So there are improvements that are being made. There are states that are working very hard on this issue to ensure the constitutional right to an attorney if you're charged with a crime and looking at the potential of facing time in jail or prison. But the reality is that there is a significant unmet need where jurisdictions across the country are dealing, you know, attorneys are dealing with caseloads that cannot possibly form the basis of adequate representation for the people who are entitled to it.
Yeah, and I'm sure that in addition, that much of the focus here probably for our conversation, and when people think about this, they think about the need for people to have attorneys when they have been charged with crimes. There are, in addition, all sorts of things that people might need legal help with, things that have to do with, you know, who knows, family law, and a variety of things where people might need some legal help. And that's, I suppose, that's a separate category, because there's certainly no obligation for people to be provided with an attorney in some case where they may need help resolving a dispute, but it's not an issue of them being charged with a crime.
That's true. So on the criminal side and in criminal cases, there's a constitutional right, as you indicated, that was the result of Supreme Court ruling, starting largely with the case of Gideon versus Wainwright in 1963. And there have been a number of cases since then that basically say if you're charged with a crime and facing a loss of liberty, meaning that you may spend some time in jail or prison, then you're entitled to have an attorney. There are cases where people are entitled to a lawyer by statute. Various jurisdictions have determined that for policy reasons, you know, if your children are going to be taken away from you, for example, or in abuse and neglect cases, that you have the right under their state statute to an attorney. Mm. And you are absolutely correct that there are a whole host of incidents or instances where individuals would need a lawyer in our society that where they don't have the right to one. So, for example, if you're getting ready to lose your home, you may not have the right to a lawyer. You wouldn't have the right to a lawyer, although there are attorneys available. Legal aid, legal services programs across the country do provide representation for people who can't afford counsel. But it's not a right, but there is that option available to some. What I will say about that, which I don't think will come in as any surprise, is that unfortunately legal aid is probably as under-resourced as the public defender system is mm-hmm. in most instances, where there's only a limited amount of resources available. But absolutely right, it's sort of interesting, and our country is considered one of those that, you know, we always look to this country as the rule of law, as a rule of law country, where that's so important. And the reality is, which most people understand, is that it's very difficult to navigate so many things in society without the assistance of an attorney. Yet, based on statistics that I've seen, looking at this issue internationally, your access to an attorney in this country is more limited than it is in other countries where their society is based on, their societal codes are different than ours and perhaps not as complex or developed. So mm-hmm. in both the criminal justice system and the civil justice system, in our country, you know, the opportunity to have access to an attorney is quite limited.
Yeah, and I'm sure that as with the kind of economic crisis that a lot of people have been experiencing the last couple of years, certainly, that there is an even greater need for people to have help with the very kinds of things that you talked about. If people have lost their source of income, there are people who are in the position that they might end up losing their homes, those kind of people are going to need help. And that's, as you say, that's a different sort of an issue. But that would just mean that the numbers of people who would need some kind of legal help and who might not be able to afford that for themselves over the past couple of years has, if anything, it has increased.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the economy is having an impact on the justice system generally, on both the civil and defender side. So the cases, you know, the number of individuals, for example, who need representation to deal with employment issues or to deal with foreclosures on the civil side are rising, while at the same time on the criminal side, the caseload crisis is really increasing because lawyers who didn't have the resources to adequately handle the number of people who needed representation before the economic downturn now find themselves in an even worse position. So I think, for example, there was a very recent, just this weekend, the Minnesota Post published a survey that they had done of public defenders in their state, and really the results are quite shocking. 60%, I think it was, of attorneys have reported putting witnesses on the stand without adequate preparation or allowing their clients to testify without adequate preparation. The survey really demonstrates the extent to which in Minnesota, for example, the economic downturn is making what is already a crisis much, much worse.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I took a look at that survey, and I'm sure that the problems that they point to, things like that attorneys may meet their clients only shortly before they end up having to represent them, and the clients, attorneys, not having the opportunity to completely review evidence, to go into having to defend someone really inadequately prepared. And so you might make the argument that in some cases having a lawyer like that is little better than having no lawyer. That may be going a little far, but you have to ask what constitutes adequate representation, and simply providing someone with a lawyer, is that really complying with the spirit of the law?
Well, absolutely, David, and let's face it, if it's your mother, father, sister, brother, relative, loved one, friend, and they are, charged with a crime and can't afford a lawyer, and one is appointed, what you hope and expect that lawyer will be able to do is adequately represent them. You know, the lawyers, the code of conduct, the rules of ethics governing attorneys require zealous representation, and that no one would expect anything less if they or a loved one were, accused of a crime. You expect there to be your case to be investigated. You expect your lawyer to talk to you about what happened, to take names of witnesses, to find out, to call those witnesses to the stand, to use experts if that's appropriate. And so, if a lawyer doesn't have, the time, tools, or training to do the job, you're right. In many instances, it's almost like not having a lawyer at all. And I would add, by the way, that in fact, even, almost going on 50 years soon since the Gideon decision, there still are people who get convicted without ever talking to a lawyer at all. And so, it's really, and as we know from the advent of DNA technology and science, I should say, we know that the system makes mistakes, with DNA now more readily available. We all know what public defenders have known for a long time, that innocent people do get convicted, and it happens more than anyone would think.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus is Joanne Wallace. She is the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. And we're talking about some of the challenges faced by programs across the country that are set up to provide lawyers, legal representation to people who are charged with crimes but don't have the means to provide a lawyer for themselves. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here, someone in the community of Danville, not that far away from us, so let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, Joanne. I was not fully familiar with the concept of home rule until a series of incidents happened in a nearby community over the past 3 years, and it made me fully aware of how much latitude the city council, the police, and the prosecutor have in picking and choosing which crimes they want to prosecute or do something about. I would have been on the plaintiff's side in this situation. However, I came close to being on the defender side in one incident. Do you recommend things like legal service plans, of which I'm a member, trouble areas, the lawyers are quite off, far away? Another question on the same vein, things like jurisdictionary.com, where you pay them $250 and then you get free legal advice, you get to learn how to be your own lawyer for things like that. What do you think of those type situations?
I certainly think that jurisdictions should have plans for the provision of legal services or for people who can't afford attorneys. And that legal representation should comply with the American Bar Association 10 principles of indigent defense. So there are national standards which lay out what systems should look like in order to provide indigent defense effectively. The ABA 10 principles really take what are voluminous national standards and sort of, you know, boil them down to sort of 10, which we regard as really the floor in terms of what characteristics an indigent defense delivery system should incorporate in order to work effectively. And certainly we also think that criminal justice planning generally should be supported and promoted. And in fact, those jurisdictions, there are jurisdictions that are doing that in a way that helps address not only the resource issue with respect to indigent defense, but in other arenas. So, for example, you know, while it is the case that right now, you know, the economic downturn or the economic conditions across the country are affecting indigent defense and affecting the crisis and really exacerbating the crisis, the fact of the matter is that there are things that states can do that don't cost money in order to address the crisis. So, for example, you know, when people think about the criminal justice system, they usually are thinking about very serious cases. The reality is that the bulk of cases in the system are nonviolent, you know, offenses, misdemeanors, low-level. They're not violent offenses. They're offenses that, in many instances, could be handled outside of the criminal justice system. And there are jurisdictions where all the stakeholders are sort of getting together and taking a look at this and saying, you know what, we need to figure out other ways of dealing with some of these issues that are still consistent with public safety and in many instances can save taxpayers money if we address some of these offenses in a different manner. So, for example, in South Carolina, they have a commission that, you know, a group of stakeholders coming together doing criminal justice planning. You know, and yes, indigent defense is part of it, but it's part of a larger sort of plan in terms of how we're going to deal with criminal justice issues and criminal justice policies, getting through mediation or diversion and other mechanisms for getting some of the cases out of the system and dealing with them more effectively. In terms of you talk about, you know, providing people the means for representing themselves, you know, in 1963 and since then, the Supreme Court said that if you are charged with a crime and you are, you know, facing a potential loss of liberty, you have a right to a lawyer. We shouldn't be looking at ways for people to represent themselves. The criminal laws are so complicated. Anyone facing a loss of liberty, and in some instances, and even worse, death, in some cases, should have the right to competent counsel, as the Supreme Court has said. Now, hello?
I don't know. Is that getting at your question, Colin?
Yeah, it's clear that the principle set forth in 63 apparently mandates some sort of criminal procedure, a help from some sort of defense. The situations I'm talking about are marginal, where, for example, I complained about some dangerous dogs for a period of about 3 years and warned the community, and then one of the dogs ended up biting a child at a daycare center next door. And I tried my best to have the state forms and all that filled out, but the police department was loath in helping with that because it would have shown them to be deficit in their responsibilities. It really opened me up on how to think about the situation. As I pursued it farther, I became a suspect myself for trying to stir up trouble, you might say, when all I was trying to do was to provide for what you might say public safety. That's my main concern in the situation.
Sure.
And it can backfire on you.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right that there are and should be mechanisms for addressing issues like that. And when I talked earlier about, you know, mediation, diversion, I mean, there are ways to address those types of issues in a community that are that are sort of short of bringing the full force of a criminal investigation and going through the complete, you know, criminal justice process that cases go through from start to finish, where things can be addressed outside of that court system, where people can come together and have conversations to determine, you know, what needs to happen, and at the same time protect public safety.
Well, I think the caller, I have somebody else I want to get to. We're also almost at our midpoint here. So just very quickly, I'd like to introduce again the guest, Joanne Wallace. She's the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. The association was founded in 1911. It is the country's oldest and largest nonprofit association of individual legal professionals and legal organizations. It's devoted to ensuring the delivery of legal services to the poor. That is how they describe themselves. They do indeed have a website if you're interested in taking a look at that and looking at some of the issues involved in providing legal services to people who can't afford them. That's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's another caller, someone in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Two things. Number one, I think you should talk a bit about exactly how much money a lawyer doesn't get, let's put it that way. Where I was a number of years ago in North Carolina, they do the system where they have a list of lawyers, and they just go down the list. And unless there's some sort of situation where the lawyers come across that person before or you know, who may be doing something to the person, to the law, they normally take the case and they get paid back. Well, this was in the 70s, $150. And you have to consider, you know, the time element and everything else. And there is certainly a lot of pressure, as I well know, to just plead guilty. Let's get this thing over with. And I'll do the best I can for you. And the case where you don't even see the fellow happened a lot, was a jailhouse lawyer for a while. And some of the things I ran across were just illegal sentences, like somebody be given 12 years of misdemeanor time. And the state law says you can have more than 8, no matter what. The state usually in a situation never turned you loose. They would just offer you parole, and, of course, it was sensible to do that. Otherwise, they would fight it all the way up, and you could spend most of your time just, you know, going to court and writing briefs and things. But I think it should be made clear that the public defender is not going to be the lawyer driving the big car and the big home and all that kind of stuff. It takes a man of a certain kind of loyalty and a code. And unfortunately, we have one in my town where I live now who got a fellow out of prison, was given 4 years for something he didn't do, and he was told that if he didn't say he was guilty, his pregnant wife would go to jail. And I thought it was rather remarkable. This man, he didn't have to do it, but he stood up tall and got all the necessary stuff done, all freebie, and got the man back on the street. So those issues at that level seem to be very important, and it just seems to be people don't want to pay that kind of money to have that kind of service for the poor. Thank you.
All right. Well, here, and I think the caller here makes a number of good points. Maybe one question or one point to make is that there are some places where some jurisdictions where they have public defender offices where people work there as lawyers, and that's their job, to be the public defender. And then there are other places where private practice lawyers who are in private practice end up doing that work for a set fee. And I would imagine in both cases, these people are not these kinds of attorneys, whether you're a public defender and that's the way you make your living, or you're a lawyer and you're doing some public defender work. They're not lavishly compensated.
That's correct. I mean, when people think about salaries for lawyers, they usually are thinking of very highly paid individuals, and that is not the case in terms of the public employees who generally speaking, in terms of public defender salaries, there is a study, a report that the Justice Department published recently, where I think that the median starting salary for entry-level attorneys was about $46,000 for a public defender. And now that data was published, the study was published this year, but the data was from 2007. Now, when you look at that $46,000 median salary, you also have to be mindful of the fact that many lawyers are coming out of law school now with loans in excess of $100,000. So if you don't, if you did not have the ability to pay for law school on your own or have your family pay for it, chances are you are coming out with debt. So many lawyers are coming out with debt upwards of, you know, six figures. So you have to balance the two. So we're not talking about people who, for the most part, in terms of public defenders, who are in the group of attorneys who are, or professionals who are at the really high end of the spectrum in terms of salaries, number one. Number two, the caller is absolutely correct that, you know, there are many things that can go wrong in a criminal justice system that end up with people being treated unfairly or innocent people getting convicted. But the reality is that there's one main safeguard against all of those things, and that is having competent counsel. And that means, you know, counsel that has that is adequately trained counsel and that has the resources that he or she needs in order to represent individuals, you know, effectively. I mentioned earlier that there are national standards that talk about, I mean, what is required both for indigent defense delivery systems and for individual counsel in criminal cases in order to provide adequate representation. The ABA 10 Principles of a Public Defense Delivery System, that's the American Bar Association, one of the 10 principles requires that, you know, defense counsel be adequately trained, that they not take cases that they don't have the ability to handle, that cases should be matched to, you know, the individual's training and experience level. And, of course, that doesn't always happen, and unfortunately, in this economic downturn, one of the first things that goes in budgets is training, which is unfortunate in this instance for many reasons, including the fact that the laws are constantly changing. So, you know, lawyers need to have continuing education and training in order to stay up with the complicated laws that are changing all the time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you read about so frequently as an issue is caseload. And there again, it seems clear that the number of clients that you represent is going to have an impact on the quality of representation for all of them. You know, the more clients you have, the less time you're going to be able to spend on each individual case. Is there something that you can say about what sort of caseloads public defenders are carrying?
Well, the caseload issue is really, when people talk about the indigent defense crisis, that's a large part of it. The reality is that across the country, defenders, public defenders, are carrying cases that are much higher than they should be. Now, when I talk about national standards, there are national standards that are used as sort of guideposts for cases. They can, you know, whether the standards should apply in any particular jurisdiction can be, you know, it depends on a lot of different factors, but as a general proposition, it's sort of a starting point for looking at caseloads. And so, you know, under the standards, those national standards, we're generally looking at carrying 150 felonies or 400 misdemeanors, felonies being the more serious cases and misdemeanors being the less serious cases. In the study that I referenced earlier that the Justice Department did, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS, they looked at state and county public defender systems and reported that 79% of those public defender systems that reported, so 15 of the 19 that actually responded, had their workload was exceeding the nationally recognized workload standards. And that, in fact, during the years from 1999 to 2007, the caseloads at state public defender offices increased about 20%, and staffing increased by just about 4%. So this is before the economic, you know, really before the downturn. And the same picture was there for county-based public defender offices. About 73% of the county-based public defender programs were exceeding national caseload standards. So, and, you know, again, this is pre-economic downturn. You know, to give you an example of how things have progressed and, you know, have gotten worse, you can look in Illinois and sort of in your backyard at Cook County, for example, where before the economic downturn, Cook County public defender was handling about double the number of felonies. The attorneys there for, you know, double national standards. And misdemeanors, they were looking at almost five times per attorney what the national standards are. So national standards are 400, and their caseloads were around 1,900 per lawyer. So if you can imagine, I mean, if you do the math and look at really how much time you're giving to each individual charge, it comes down to minutes in some instances. Now, all of this is before the current situation where right now in Cook County there's a recommendation from what we understand of a 21% budget cut. So that's going to, of course, exacerbate that, make that much, much worse.
Yeah. You know, something that I want to go back to something that you've mentioned, and I have certainly seen also written about in some of the material that I've looked at, and that is, you know, I think that people understand that there is this requirement. They may not know about the Supreme Court case, but for close to 50 years, there has been this requirement that when someone's charged with a crime, if they can't afford to have a lawyer, one will be provided. And maybe if all you watch are police dramas, you get that idea that that people are told that. And so they have this idea that, yes, someone is charged with a crime, they can't afford a lawyer, they're going to get one. But one does hear about it, and you mentioned the fact that there are places in the United States today where people are charged, tried, and sentenced without any lawyer at all. How does that happen?
Well, it happens in different ways in different jurisdictions. So, for example, in Colorado, there's actually a statute which is now being contested in court, but a statute that says that, you know, you, before you get an attorney appointed, you have to talk to the prosecutor. Well, you know, you can imagine that after that conversation, many people don't ask for lawyers. There are a variety of, you know, pressure is put on people in a variety of ways to not ask for a lawyer. You can imagine if you are picked up and put in jail, charged with a misdemeanor, meaning a not very serious offense, oftentimes because there isn't adequate access to counsel, you know, people will sit in jail for lengthy periods of time. Sometimes they can be in jail for even longer than the sentence they would get if they were found guilty. And so then you finally get your day in court, and they ask you if you want a lawyer, but then tell you if you ask for a lawyer that you'll have to sit in jail until you get one, and it can be a lengthy process and more delay. And, you know, people at that point, they may already have lost a job or be in jeopardy of losing a job because they've been absent, which can have all sorts of repercussions in terms of, you know, losing your home, and it builds from there. You know, if you are told you know, you can get out now or you can wait and have a lawyer who can represent you and maybe prove your innocence, you know, that there's tremendous pressure to say thank you, goodbye, right then and there for people, not realizing often the consequences of even misdemeanor convictions. You know, once that's on your record, it's very difficult to undo, and it can have consequences for employment. It can have consequences for immigration, you know, for deportation if you're depending on your immigration status and beyond. I mean, the reality is in our country that the way we punish people, the punishment keeps on, you know, it's almost a life sentence if you have a criminal conviction in many respects in terms of the repercussions. So there are, you know, NLADA does studies of jurisdictions across the country, and one of the jurisdictions that we've been looking at is Idaho. And one thing I want to say about Idaho is that they really are beginning to look at counsel issue in a more systematic way and looking at their criminal justice system more generally to see, you know, what steps can be taken to shrink their system some, to get some of the cases out of their system. However, you know, in the meantime, there, our report is documenting the fact that people charged with misdemeanors often plead guilty without access to counsel for a number of different reasons, and there's pressure put on people in a variety of ways. So the example I gave you happens in Idaho. There was a instance where the court clerk was telling an individual that they have a right to counsel, but you know, you can meet with the prosecutor today if you want to get a lawyer. You can, but you probably don't want to do that. Sometimes it's subtle and sometimes not so subtle pressure to just resolve the case and right then and there, as opposed to waiting for counsel to be assigned.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Joanne Wallace. She's the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. She's also been a public defender herself. She worked for the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia for 14 years, was its director for 6 years. And we're talking about some of the pressures faced by public defenders and the systems that are supposed to be in place across the country to provide legal advice, legal counsel, and representation to people charged with crimes who were too poor to afford their own lawyer. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, and this will be line one. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
Yes.
Okay. Speaking from a local observation of what's happened in our court, is there a possibility that provided attorneys are there to particularly protect the courts from the claim that things are not done without representation, and that in general, in the line of harassing people somewhat, that they go about simply to provide labor for our local prison industries? That's the question.
I'm not sure the question is completely clear. I don't know, Ms. Wallace, do you have a sense of what the caller is getting at?
I'm not sure, honestly, that I couldn't exactly hear everything you were saying. Could you repeat it for me?
Okay. Locally, it seems that the providing of attorneys largely protects the court from the idea that representation was not available. Whether the representation was adequate or useful might have been an ordinary question, and that in the line of harassing some groups of people, we have many different ethnic and other societies in this community, that the court has simply gone to the trouble of providing laborers for our local prison industries.
Let me see if I can approach it this way. If I understand your question, your concern, it's about lawyers being provided that aren't really providing the protection that lawyers were meant to provide. I think we talked about this a little bit earlier in saying that in many instances, you know, there are lawyers that don't have the training or the time or the resources to provide adequate representation. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, as a practical matter, it's almost that's like having no lawyer at all. And certainly that is the case in many instances. Even if you have a lawyer who has too many cases, then that's going to be, you know, one of the results is going to be that at least some of those people, if not all, are not going to get representation that we would consider adequate by any means. And each person charged should receive, as you know, representation from competent counsel that has the training and the resources to do the job. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, maybe what the caller is getting at, and if not, I think it's still probably an appropriate question, is something about quality control. That is, who is responsible for trying to see to it that the quality of representation that people get from public defenders is good. That is, the lawyers are good. They're doing their job. They're capable. They're well trained and so forth.
The national standards call for independence of the public defense function, so that there should be an independent oversight capacity provided that ensures quality control. Hmm. And so, in many states, will have a statewide commission. For example, in the District of Columbia, there's a board of trustees that is responsible for setting policy for the public defender service, and that model is replicated in many jurisdictions, although not all. In fact, there are many jurisdictions where where there is no oversight, quality oversight, that the individual lawyers, we've talked a lot about the public defender system, but in our country, most cases are actually, representation is provided by what we call an assigned counsel system or some variation of that, where private attorneys are appointed by the court to handle cases. Mm-hmm. And in many jurisdictions, those lawyers are appointed by judges, and not necessarily on the basis of the fact that they are the most competent attorney for the job. In some jurisdictions where there are elected officials, we have found instances where judges appoint based on, you know, who's been donating to their campaigns, unfortunately. Or sometimes it's the pressure of trying to move cases through the system that can have an impact on appointments. So, you know, judges are under a lot of pressure to move cases, and sometimes that is often at the, you know, that means sacrificing quality representation. If you don't file motions, if you don't question witnesses, you know, cases can move faster, not necessarily with correct and lasting and fair results. And so if judges know that certain attorneys are going to stand their ground and provide the zealous representation that the case and the ethical rules require, they may not be inclined to appoint that attorney and in favor of getting their docket moving faster. So, you know, there are very sound policy reasons why the national standards require independence and, you know, oversight, yes, by an independent body that understands the national standards, has the requisite, you know, expertise and focus, and separation from, you know, considerations that are inappropriate in terms of developing policy for defenders. It shouldn't be the judges who are supposed to be neutral arbiters who are making sort of calls about representation. It should be left strictly to the attorneys and, as I said, the independent oversight bodies that set policy for the system.
I have a couple of minutes left. We have one more caller. We'll want to try to get here in Champaign County, here where we are, line number two. Hello.
The last caller also had this line about plantation and prison industry, and that was perfected in the plantation days of Jim Crow. I don't really know if it goes on around here, but it's really not germane. But if it's happening around here, it's horrible. Now, what is happening around here, there's a phenomenon called city court, where the impoverished, homeless, and otherwise disenfranchised are pretty much railroaded without any kind of attorney. And I don't know the specifics of how it's done, how they escape having any representation. It seems like it might be because it's sort of a municipal infraction, and that consequently doesn't really qualify. I'm not sure. There's some details written up in a local journal by Belden Fields, and if the host wants to have a local story about how this phenomenon is happening locally, I think he'd be a good source for that. But I just wanted you to comment on that, and whether how many that you mentioned a number of ways that people escape the constitutional the judicial requirement for representation. And maybe that's another one of them. But what about other countries? You've done a little bit of cross analysis, and also in the states. What is there a state that has implemented better? And are there any other models that you could point out at where this is done well? I mean, obviously, it just requires some kind of funding and detail to get some good attorneys to take these cases. I know the local system is really swamped. Statistics are probably not as bad as Chicago's. So I'd like for you to react to that.
We're only have about a couple of minutes left, but I do appreciate particularly the question about whether there are other places. Are there places you can point to where you say they actually do a really good job with this?
Well, there certainly are states that, if you look at their systems compared to the 10 principles, for example, the ABA 10 principles, that they are meeting a significant number of them, or at least the critical, some of the foundational ones. Colorado, even though we talked earlier about the statute that's being challenged right now, is one of those states that's generally looked on as, meeting more of the standards. Minnesota, before the economic crisis, is another jurisdiction. So there are about 27 states that, depending on what statistics you look at, between 25 and 27 states that where the public defense function is totally state funded. There are quite a number of those states that have some independent oversight. There's a continuum, really, where some states are doing, much better than others. You can look at a number of different indicators, including per capita spending, to see where states are. Illinois is 31st, by the way, in terms of per capita the spending, or the dollars per person, if you look at it that way. And certainly there are jurisdictions where the policymakers have taken the right to counsel seriously, and they are working very hard to comply with that mandate. And if you look at Louisiana, that is a state where, their system has been in turmoil that, as you can imagine, was exacerbated by Hurricane Katrina and then Rita, and that state is really turned their system around. The number of resources that they've dedicated have gone up. They've passed legislation that complies with the ABA 10 principles. And really, that's the starting point for systems, is looking at those 10 principles and looking at, their system, and then working to comply with them. I know we're about ready to run out of time, so a couple of quick points. I mean, the last two callers talked about our prisons, and, you know, unquestionably we incarcerate more people than any other country in the civilized world, and it is an issue that everyone in America should be concerned about. Not only does it impact the topic that we're talking about, we talked earlier about if we can control costs elsewhere through the criminal justice system, that would help us get a handle on making sure that people who have a right to counsel before they get convicted and sent to prison have one. But it also impacts how much money we have available to spend on education, on health care, and on other things that are important to the quality of life. So this isn't an issue that only people in the criminal justice system should care about. Everybody should care about it. And unfortunately, what you mentioned earlier, what we see on TV does not depict what is really happening. We did some research or worked with a research firm in, you know, 2000 to 2002, and what we found was that, you know, Americans understand the right to counsel, and they believe that it's critically important to our democracy, to fairness in our courts. What they didn't know was just how often people aren't being provided lawyers. So
we have to stop there. I'm sorry to jump in on you. We're at the end of the time. If people would like to read more about the subject, you can look for the website of the organization here we're talking about. Our guest, Joanne Wallace, is the president and CEO of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. Find out more about it and the issue by going to their website, nlada.org. And Ms. Wallace, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, David, for your coverage on this important topic.